For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
En fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie, et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi, et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent.
Tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast about how artists do their work and make a living. I'm Nicole Cabrera.
I'm Erica Thomas, and this month we're welcoming Vovo. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Are you going to read their statement, or do you have something you
No,
like
I think
to
we
say?
Can do our usual, we can let Vovo introduce mm-hmm. themselves. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about yourself as an artist and what you do?
Sure. I'm a newly initiated artist. I guess I started my career, I would say, probably maybe a year and a half ago. And I'm an anarchist and abolitionist and also anti-racist. And so a lot of my work centers on those three, I guess, philosophical backgrounds. I've been an anarchist since I was 12, and it's kind of a large part of my approach to understanding community and you know, everything, I guess, society, structures, institutions, and then kind of the visual art piece has like an interesting piece in that whole structure.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you only recently started your art career. Mm-hmm. How did you decide, you know, all of a sudden, I'm going to start making art?
Yeah, I think that I grew up with not much encouragement, or actually a lot of discouragement from making art, and I was actually forbidden to like make a lot of creative things as a teenager up until I was 21. So I wasn't permitted to like draw or like do. I was inclined as a young person to like, I would paint on my clothes and my shoes, and I would dye everything, and you know, I had a really wacky sense of style, and I made all my clothes from scratch, but that was really highly discouraged in my culture and in my family, so I had to kind of do a lot of that stuff in secret. But also what it meant was I didn't have any resources or supplies or any connections or community that I could do that with. So I didn't start drawing until I would say about 7 years ago, and I still feel like I'm learning how to draw and be an illustrator. I've published a few comics, and most recently a graphic novel from a year ago, but I still don't really know what I'm doing. And then I got offered a full scholarship to a master's in fine arts about 2.5 years ago online, and like I got offered online, and I was like, oh, that's nice. Hadn't thought about ever becoming an artist, hadn't thought about officially studying it, but it felt like a nice invitation, so I took it. So I graduated in June of 2020, and that's when I guess initiated being like a professional artist, so to speak. But I don't think there are hard and fast lines between the academy or having to be institutional or having to be codified or canonized or official in any way in order to do what you want to do. So I think it kind of depends on how you define that. I think I just define it like I've started making a livable wage in mm-hmm. June of 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, congratulations. I feel like that's always like a big deal when you finish any type of schooling, really. And I think some of the work that you've done. Like, I really specifically like your sort of like black and white stuff. I actually just took a class like last term, and I really like your work. That was really cool to look at and look at the little technique that I also learned. Be like, oh, people really do this. But yeah.
Do you mean black and white drawings?
The pen work, I'm trying to think, there's one of like the ice glaciers. I really like that one a lot.
Yeah, I really like
your drawings. Can you tell us a little bit more about sort of how you incorporate a lot of the ideas that you mentioned, like the ideas of like anarchism, right? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of stuff. How do you work those ideas into the work that you make?
Yeah, I think that, like, you know, in talking to a lot of, you know, young people who are trying to find kind of either their voice or their place or their role or their purpose or meaning, either in an art context or any kind of social context, it goes back to, how do you feel connected to the world around you? How do you feel like you relate? How do you feel the most yourself, you know? So for me, I feel most myself when I'm critiquing like institutional structures and questioning and trying to visibilize some of the things that people live under or in amongst with that maybe not everyone sees or at least thinks about. So like my last solo exhibition, which was earlier this year, was just a lot of like interrogating those things through embroidery and large scale illustration that was all embroidered on really large banners and weavings. So I think using those principles and being anti-capitalist and being anti-authoritarian and anti-prison, you know, anti-police, all of these things, kind of just like a starting point of that's just where I situate myself socially and politically. And then artistically, I just try to use the media that I'm choosing to discuss those things. And sometimes it's to people that already agree with me, and most of the time it's to people that don't either agree with me or genuinely haven't really thought about it before. So that's one way of answering that question. I think the other part that's important for me is that I grew up having art not be accessible to me as a kid and as a teenager. However, I think it's really important that it is accessible to all classes and all backgrounds, and not just like saved for a specific class of people or people who can afford it or people who happen to be lucky enough to be introduced to it. So I also really believe that art should be free to access, free to view, free to experience, public and community driven and community like facing. So there's just some like beliefs that come from my political background that help me approach how I visualize art as a practice.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting to hear like you're coming to art through politics, and I feel like I came to politics through art, but nonetheless another thing that I'm picking up on is like there's a lot of language that I think that artists that we get when we are political artists or politically engaged in any way that we toss terms around, and then sometimes I realize when I'm talking with like teenagers that they don't actually have a good clear definition of what some of those things are.
Right.
How would you describe anarchism to a young person who was curious or might have heard a little bit about it or maybe nothing at all, and they want to know what you mean by that when you say that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of tenets to anarchism, and like I said, I was 12 or 13 when I like officially identified as one, so I think that there was something intuitive. I was in seventh grade in Sydney, Australia. And at the time, there was nuclear testing off the coast in the Pacific that France was doing. And, you know, I was introduced to anarchism through protesting nuclear testing on Indigenous waters that was clearly, like, not consensual and exploitative and also really destructive for the ecosystem. So there's just, like, when you're young, and hopefully when you're older, you know what's fair and what's not fair, and you know what feels like unjust, and you know intuitively and deeply when people are being taken advantage of or when people are being exploited or abused, right? So starting with that kind of compass, understanding and seeing the ways that things like governments or state control or state violence, like police violence, prisons, even school systems, seeing the way that capitalism or work or the way that people are abused through work systems, it do end up abusing people or exploiting people. So understanding how those things, the result of those things, and experiencing firsthand, oh, you know, y'all are being not treated well as people or as communities as a result of these larger mechanisms that usually are controlled by people that don't have any connection to how it's impacting communities. So mm-hmm. anarchism, I guess, as a definition, is like realizing that a lot of the systems we live in are violent and exploitative, and wanting to dismantle them and think of new ways to relate to one another so that we cannot be you know, exploitative of one another, and like allow people to have fair lives and just lives and fruitful and thriving lives beyond that. And a lot of that sometimes means relying on our connections and relationships to solve a problem instead of calling like a state professional, because often they don't solve the problem, they make the problem worse. So that's one way of describing it. There's, I know that if you ask another anarchist, they'll describe it completely differently. That's kind of the beauty of it too, is that it's there's anarcho-syndicalism, there's anarcho-primitivism, there's all different approaches to it, and you know, that's the freedom of it. But I think essentially, like, don't do things because other people tell you it's the thing to do. Do things because it feels like the fairest thing, or it feels like the thing that will benefit the community the best. And use your intuition and your judgment that you've built over time, rather than just kind of blindly like obeying what kind of power structures might tell you to do. So that's one way of defining it.
That's great. Thanks.
Yeah. The other piece is like the abolitionist piece, which is another long, big capital A word people throw around. And again, that specifically nowadays, it means believing that, you know, the prison system, the justice system, and the police system are racist at its heart, anti-Indigenous, anti-Black. And the continuation of those systems just continue the punishment and exclusion of those communities, rather than actually working to like heal societal issues that cause so-called crime. So that's just like one way to look at abolitionism as well.
Well, you spoke a little bit about, you know, how systems take advantage of people, and you have traveled definitely around the world, and I was just curious, like, what are some of the different things that you see in each country, or, you know, similar things, and how does that also incorporate into the work that you make?
When you say similar things, can you give me more information?
So just like what are some of the issues that are kind of same from country to country, and what is also different? Just, yeah, kind of comparing the two, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say like imperialism, which is the control of land and people and resources by taking over space, like claiming space that can be through opening military bases. It can be through invasion or occupation or dispossession or displacing people. It could be through gentrification. It could be through opening up new offices of a multinational company. You know, there's all the different ways imperialism works. Colonization, which is like a memorial, like a thing that's happened for a really long time, that is a system that prioritizes itself and thinks that it's the only solution to other people's livelihoods and imposes itself on them regardless of whether it's good or not for those folks, and you know, has caused genocide and erasure of like culture and language and histories. So yeah, imperialism, colonization, capitalism, you know, growing up, going to Vietnam since I was a kid and seeing how, in a communist country, seeing how the encroachment of like US specific capitalism has shaped and changed, not for the better, the way people consume and relate to one another and create waste and stuff. I would say waste, like, you know, just ecological waste and abuse is another system, another repeated theme. And then like specifically anti-blackness or anti-indigeneity, in the way that racism and also Islamophobia, in, if I'm going to think about every country that I've been to, like, I would say Islamophobia, all of these things that are just constantly impacting people in a way that's really not good for their humanity, and splitting up families and not allowing people to live where they need to live and stuff like that.
Something I really appreciated looking through your work online is seeing that your willingness to be critical of these things isn't exempted in the communities that you're a part of, including like punk, for example. It's like you have a lot of writing that's kind of critical of punk, or it's like critical, or it's examining the communities that you belong to that are also contain racism and also contain Islamophobia and also contain colonialist attitudes about things or things like that. So I just wondered if you wanted to talk any about your experiences with writing and making that zine.
I'm not sure which so I guess like historically, because I wasn't allowed to kind of express myself visually, I expressed myself through writing to myself, and then that about 11 years ago kind of evolved into accidentally becoming a zine that was published, and then that ended up, I think 8 years ago, ended up into two national US tours that I was invited on, and that's kind of how I got introduced to living on the West Coast here. So the zine was kind of accidental. Writing was always just a thing that that I did to survive and to try to like process my thoughts, and it still is. One zine that I did the two tours on was called Fix My Head, and it was an anarchist BIPOC zine. And it was, I would just write kind of the editorial at the beginning, but then it would be a collection of global BIPOC who are anti, you know, authoritarian, and to talk about their politics and their art, and specifically like why they are radical and why they, how they express their kind of radical politics through their either visual art or music or dance or poetry. It was like all different types of artists and academics that were part of that. So for me, that was more like community building. I was really lonely in Australia. It's a pretty racist place, and it's not a place where people welcome this type of discussion. Like, frankly, people just thought I was too intense or too, like, they just thought I was troublemaking when I would say, hey, I feel weird about, you know, how anti-Aboriginal that was or anti-Black that felt. That would just be like shot down pretty fast as a kid and as an older anarchist. So yeah, so me making a zine was just a way to reach out and see globally who I could connect to and maybe relate to beyond kind of folks in Australia who I was not really experiencing that connection with. And then, you know, accidentally kind of stumbled across being invited to these tours, and that created more chances for me to make community within the States as well. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like writing, as much as like drawing and as much as now it's like weaving and embroidery, large scale drawings, all of these things are kind of a mode of expression for me. They're not anything really beyond just me trying to express like a feeling that I have in a moment. And I know that different people who make art have different reasons for doing art, but for me it's channeling just a need that I have in that moment, and usually the need is some kind of distance or depression or isolation or not feeling like really anyone kind of understands my point of view. So I'm just putting it on paper, and then maybe someone in 10 years could maybe understand, or maybe no one will understand, but that's okay because I feel better in the moment for having put it on paper.
Mm-hmm. I think that's relatable to any artist, I think. Nicole, I don't want to take too much floor time. Do you have burning questions that you want to toss in?
Well, I think you kind of spoke a little bit on it, but I figure I still ask. You touch on a lot of like social issues, just like you kind of cover all of it. But I feel like sometimes for some people it can be such a downer, because I recently watched this documentary about Greta Thunberg, and she spoke about how when you see an issue in the world, it's really hard to turn it off and pretend like it doesn't exist. And she talked about how it's always like manifested in her, and how it's hard for her to not think about climate change and stuff like that. So I was wondering, you know, is there anything that you do for yourself to pretty much do like self-care when dealing with topics like this?
There's probably a few things, but first I want to say that Greta Thunberg, comes from a upper middle class family. She's a white person. She's there's a plenty that she doesn't have to think about, and that's like the privileges that she is privy to. And similarly, like, I'm not a black person, I'm not an indigenous person, I'm a settler colonizer in the United States, so there's plenty that I can switch off from thinking about. You know, there are other people with lived experiences who have to think about things all the time, and no matter what kind of self-care happens, it's not gonna go away, and it's not gonna be, you know, something that can kind of like be forgotten about, because that's the lived experience. So I try to hold space for folks in lots of different ways whose lived experiences are way less privileged than mine. I have a privilege of being able to travel, of having community that will help me out when I need assistance or resources. Part of my self-care is, one, holding space for other people who have less privilege than me, and recently, because of health stuff, I've also like drawn boundaries around being available for people all the time. So that's another type of self-care, is just understanding my boundaries and being clear about setting them. And then also, this is gonna sound like interesting, I don't know how to express this, but also knowing when to get out of the way, and when to know like when I'm just being a crappy support person, or when I'm being toxic, or when I'm just a drain on somebody else's energy or resources or time or attention. And the self-care in that sense is just me being like, you know what, I'm not a benefit to you, this friendship is more for me and not for you, and I think maybe we can like have boundaries here too. So so kind of knowing my positionality, and knowing when it feels like a mutual you know, connection, and then sometimes when it isn't, like, how do I address that, and being clear about those things and not just letting them slide. And obviously, like, my professional job is through education, anti-racist education, and I wouldn't do that if that wasn't nourishing to me in some kind of way. So I mm-hmm. think teaching folks and having folks, like, expand their knowledge and seeing that on a daily basis, of that kind of expansion of, like, oh, I didn't know that this morning, and now I know this thing, and I'm more aware of this thing, and I'm able to show up for people around me in a more caring way. So fostering care, or care mongering, or mutual aid encouragement, like, all of these different practices are part of my self-care. Is how do I multiply care? How do I make it sustainable? How do I pass on knowledge so that people don't feel like they have to buy care or consume care or go to a gatekeeper for care one at a time? How can they reproduce care in their own sustainable ways that feel the most relevant for them? So those are some of my answers. It's continual work, and also it depends on your context, right? So if mm-hmm. you are an individual with whatever positionality, but there's, like, toxic things that you're either putting out or that you're absorbing, how do you recognize those things and address them and rectify them? And similarly, how do you leverage kind of the access that you do have to serve other people or to help other people and create kind of more care for folks around you? So it just depends on your context, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also wanted to ask about, you know, how you travel. You mentioned that you do get to travel the world, and that's something we always like to ask about, like, how do you, you know, find the funding, and how do you get these opportunities to do the stuff that you do?
Yeah, so I became a U.S. citizen June of last year, which is kind of the reason I was finally allowed to be a public abolitionist, because before you get your citizenship in the States, you can have the application taken away from you if you're deemed as unpatriotic. So if you say anything against the administration or against the government in a public way on your, and they monitor your organization, social media, they can just take away your application. My application had been open for 30 years. So I had been waiting for my citizenship for 30 years, which meant that was 30 years of not being able to enter the country for over 3 months, because then it puts you on a alert that they think that you're trying to live here illegally. So I couldn't visit my parents for a very long time at a time. I couldn't be public about my politics, and I couldn't. I didn't even have social media for a long time because of all these monitoring systems that they really threaten you with taking away this thing. So I was a kid when I started this attempt to immigrate to rejoin my family. My family was split up after the Vietnam War as refugees, and I was trying to reunite with my parents and my grandparents, who had passed away. My grandparents, all four of them, passed away before June of last year. So before I actually got the citizenship and finally was able to live here permanently and to publicly be myself, you know, the people that I'd initially applied for to rejoin, we never reunited because they passed away. So the traveling was a secondary symptom of not being allowed to live where I wanted to live. So not being allowed to live in the same country as my parents, not being allowed to visit my family members for over 3 months at a time, and also being schooled in Australia, which was a place that I absolutely had a horrible time existing in, meant that I didn't want to be in Australia and I couldn't be where I wanted to be. So the only other option was, I'll just, like, explore, you know, other cultures and live in a few other places while I'm waiting for my green card to enter the States, which I did 7 years ago, and waiting for this application process to finally finish. So that's, like, symptomatic. It wasn't, like, intentional. And then the other part of it is being split up from your family at a really young age meant that you just become more independent by default, and you kind of, like, so I was 21 when like we were split up through immigration processes. I was knocked back, but they were accepted, so they came to the States and I wasn't allowed. And that's obviously when I also started to be creative, because I could finally kind of break free from a lot of cultural expectations. So kind of one being like self-reliant or independent, but two being completely rootless and not knowing, like not having a place that I really called home. I'm from New Zealand. I was born in New Zealand, so like that's the closest thing I have to calling home, but I haven't been there since I was like 8 years old. I haven't lived there since I was 8 years old. I think curiosity and a landlessness or a rootlessness are the two things that underlay me moving to, I think I moved to Vietnam, Nepal, Mexico, England, Germany, a couple other places. Like I lived in those places for a while whilst waiting for this application. Funding was just through full-time work. I like would work full-time, save money, and then go live somewhere for a year. There was no like magical secret to it. It was just saving up money from full-time jobs. And similarly, that's what I've done. Like, that's what I've always done. And right now I'm about to take 6 months off. That's after me saving up, you know, money from full-time work. And it's probably going to be a continued pattern so that I can allow myself like time and space to reflect on things and be creative. But there is, you know, in the United States, in Oregon, there's lots of programs and opportunities for people to find funding. Oregon Arts Commission, Regional Arts and Culture Council, off the top of my head, but there's so many. They're all centralized. You can go online and find the grants portal. So people have ways to access funding. It's just a matter of like uploading a portfolio and just going for it. And the worst that can happen is people say no and you just keep applying. But generally what I always tell people is like, be, you know, honest, deliver what you promise, and also be truthful to like what it is that you want to say and do. Don't design something just because you think that's what they want to hear or see, but obviously as artists you want to be you know, truthful in the way that you approach things, and sometimes it's a journey just to find that truth, or like it might take a while. It took me, you know, at least a decade. So but I think people can tell when they're reading those applications, like when someone's genuine or not, or when someone's not like sure of their identity as an artist or not. So I would always start to calibrate your own practice before seeking kind of other validations or other supports, just so that you can be sure of your own, like your own theoretical framework.
We ask everybody that question, but I think that's maybe the most different answer that we've gotten.
Oh, the question really about travel?
The question about funding.
Funding, all right, cool.
Yeah. I think it's nice for young artists to understand all the different pathways that exist, like having a job and self-funding your work for indefinitely or for some amount of time with breaks, or not doing that and choosing to live really cheaply so that you can like try, experiment.
Yeah, it was pathways. I worked full-time during my master's in fine arts and it was completely frowned upon. Like people had a really high expectation of me not working, and I was like, that's not an option for me. I'm gonna work full-time and study full-time in order to survive. So yeah, that's not gonna be negotiable. And I also don't believe in forcing people to choose anything. Like my job was as a social worker because I believe in doing that work. It's still really important to me to serve communities in that way. And now I do it in a different way, but I resent people like expecting me to choose between doing work that's servicing a community and doing work that's maybe more like gratuitous and like for my own self-expression, because I want to do both, and I have a right to choose both. I think like folks who are multidisciplinary, and that goes to like 12-year-olds who are multidisciplinary, you're always going to have people who are trying to force you to be classified or categorized or to choose something, and you don't have to. Like, they just want to do that for ease, their own convenience. Like, what are you? Are you a video artist? Are you a musician? Are you da da da? Doesn't matter, and you shouldn't have to give up parts of yourself as an artist or as a person just to appease someone else's desire to put you in a category. So,
yeah. You just spoke about, you know, not choosing a certain sort of media that you work with. And we spoke a little bit before about like what is the thought process of, you know, choosing some sort of project to work on, and how do you choose which medium or way of media you choose to present it in?
Yeah, I'm pretty responsive to environments, and that's something I say a lot. And I don't mean just being site specific, but being responsive to like the city that I'm living in and what's even possible. So like a lot of the travel that I did in my kind of early 20s was through making music, and we toured Asia, Southeast Asia, New Zealand, Australia, you know, like we were able to travel and tour through making music, because that's what people liked, and that's what they invited us to their homes and to play for them, and that's, you know, what happened at that time. And you know, at the time I could have really been stubborn about just choosing sculpture or something, but that might not have brought me to really cool like island in the Philippines in the same way. So I think kind of I do a lot of accepting invitations, and I, you know, try not to go where I'm not invited. And even my professional work, I don't advertise at all. I've never have, and I've been doing it for 11 years total. I only respond to requests, and similarly my art is the same. It's like if people, you know, need something, a space filled, or a they want like something to address something, or they're trying to achieve something in their programming, and they know what I'm about, they'll ask me to just do something. They don't know what it is, they don't care what it is, they just want me to do something that fulfills this thing that they're hoping to fulfill. So that's like one thing. And then the other thing is Berlin. When living in Berlin for 5 years, the approach to art making there is extremely different to the States. There's less liability concerns, there's more freedom, there's more multidisciplinary approaches that are acceptable. And so knowing the limitations and kind of what's possible somewhere is important. Most of the stuff I did in Berlin in exhibitions would not be possible, physically possible, legally possible, health and safety possible here. So that's another, like, you know, restriction. And then
I'm so curious, though. I'm so curious what some examples of those pieces or projects
we made a Tesla coil and made lightning inside of the building, and then we took it outside and made lightning outside of the building. You probably couldn't do that here. That's one example. I built this giant kind of racetrack that filled up like 4 or 5 massive rooms of the Kunstraum Kreuzberg, which is like a giant art hall, which again probably wouldn't meet like fire safety regulations in this state. There's just like so many examples, right? And most of the work that I would do, most of the work that I want to do and would like to do, I can't physically do it in the States. So like So I just do what fits in the building, what people are comfortable with. Like when you work with curators or people who are stewards of their spaces, they're pretty particular about what they're okay with, and it's their homes sometimes, you know, so or their pseudo homes. So you just want to be respectful of people's safety and comfort level. So you go, okay, well, I'll do this thing that's much smaller than I would normally do, but I'll do it because that's what you've asked me to do, and that's what you're comfortable with. And the other thing I was going to say was, moving to the States, there's a specific history here of enslavement and colonization. So you can't ignore, like Greta was saying about, you know, not ignoring climate change. You can't ignore the history that this country was built on. And so I can't ignore that. And so that's part of the work that I do, is in response to this thing that is really specific to where I am. And there's places in the world where there aren't the same legacies, and so you are responding to different legacies or different histories. So that's another major, I would say, major part of being responsive, or being an analytical of where you are.
Erica, did you want to ask anything else before I ask our sort of final question?
I think we have enough time to sneak in a couple more. I'm curious a little bit more about some process or some like logistical types of questions.
Sure.
That's another sort of veil I like to reveal to on the show for young people who are like, how does stuff get made actually?
Sure.
And so I wonder if you would share any of your process of music making. I noticed in listening to your music, you use unconventional objects to make sounds. There's found sound or sort of recorded site recordings, and in gorgeous music, I really, really enjoyed. I've never heard your music before until researching the show, so I was really excited to be exposed to that. But if you want to share anything about your process of music making, how do you take a musical concept, an album concept, and turn it into the finished thing?
Sure. I think just starting from whatever point you're most comfortable with is a good like beginning. I think often people are scared to begin or scared to fail, and so they don't ever begin. And just do the easiest thing first. And so for me, the reason I use field recordings is because I often am listening to my environment, and there's a lot of sounds that are interesting, and I'm usually capturing them on my phone or just whenever. And then once I have a decent collection or a decent variation in my field recordings, then I start to think about how this could build a textural soundscape or a body of work that is cohesive in some way. So I actually start with the field recordings, and then I loosely write music around the actual field recordings. But that's my approach only because that's what is the most accessible to me. As someone who is new to technology and doesn't really like using a lot of production tools, and isn't resourced in those things very much. As someone who traveled a lot and lived out of a backpack, you don't tend to like carry around a mixing desk, but I did carry around an acoustic guitar, or I was able to access one. So just like do what you can within your reach and start, and then see where the start takes you. The start can, and again, this applies to visual art or like installation art or video art or whatever. See where the start takes you. See if it also brings you new ideas, or something comes out of it that you didn't expect organically. Like it might point you to more directions that you hadn't planned on, and that's okay. And then like you can always add to things and you can always take them away. You don't, when you add something, you don't have to keep it there. You're not tied to it. You're not committed to it. So you have a choice around what you leave in and what you don't include. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, like everything I've made is just like with one microphone and one program, depending on whatever is around. And, you know, I'm pretty new to computers as well. And I used to record on tape machines because it was just like easier for me to understand something in front of me visually. Yeah, and then the other thing is, for a long time people, you know, were like, your music is a bummer, it's really dark, it's really sad. Or they'll say, like, people will make comments about like my weird song structures. And I would always say, yeah, a lot of the stuff I make comes from like a Buddhist prayer background, because that's what I grew up with, Buddhist temple music. Or it's based on, it's really similar to a structure of a Vietnamese folk song, because again, that's what I grew up with. But I think people will always want to tell you again where you fit in, what you're doing, how it's wrong, or how it doesn't fit into their idea of like a song structure or a classical structure or a traditional painting structure, whatever the thing is. So sometimes it's about knowing why or where it comes from, and sometimes you don't even have to know. That's fine. You don't have to make excuses, or you don't have to justify your own viewpoint. But if you like it and it's what makes sense to you, then do it. Don't do it because, again, some, you know, school of thought says this is how you make a song. You have to lay down these tracks first. You have to lay these tracks next. But yeah, I think like Billie Eilish, for example, is a really good example of someone who was exposed to a lot of knowledge, but also did things the way that they wanted to in their own home. They recorded at home. Came up with pretty unconventional songs that that a lot of people related to. So I think that's a good example of, you know, someone who's current, who didn't necessarily like go to traditional music school and recording school and production school and followed a bunch of rules. So yeah, but if the rules help you, then use the rules.
Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to talk about or share with us?
I don't know. I think that I'm just like a person that has like been a result of kind of the circumstances that I've grew up with, like being a poor kid, being a kid that moved down around a lot, being a kid that was homeless, being waiting around for like, you know, paperwork, and that ended up meaning that I was in situations I wasn't expecting to be in. And I think that sometimes we aren't in the family we want to be in. Sometimes we're not in the neighborhood we want to be in. Sometimes we're not in the body we want to be in. And it can feel really heavy and like really, really all encompassing. And then we remember that art is like a bridge, you know, a bridge outside of that, a bridge to escape that sometimes, a bridge to like survive it, or, you know, figure it out with other people or figure it out by yourself. But, you know, it's a channel that can like, can take you beyond sometimes the things that you feel limited by. So I think, yeah, I just think, I don't know, and it's okay to be a bummer, I guess, is the other part of it. Is don't be afraid to be a bummer, because most of the world is bummed out, and people will appreciate your honesty or relate to you if you're a bummer. Don't change your message for other people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that kind of answers our question, but I'll still ask it anyways. Do you have like any specific advice that you would give to sort of the younger generation of artists?
I think that often, like, I work a lot with people like under 18, and I think often adults and like older people treat, you know, younger people like they don't know what they're talking about, and it's just not true. And I often see on a daily basis, like even like a 6-year-old having their power taken away from them, and it like sucks, and it shouldn't be happening at all. And so I think that sometimes you do feel like other people are trying to push you into something or telling you something, but in your heart of hearts you know that they're wrong, or you know that that you have the right idea. It's just that maybe people don't understand what you're trying to communicate. So yeah, I think the communication part is the struggle, and I think art or writing or talking or calling your friend or texting or whatever, Minecraft, whatever, can be the thing that is helping you form the communication that you want to have to explain better to other people what it is you want to say. Because otherwise I've noticed that adults just tend to assume what you're saying, and then they'll like tell you why you're wrong. And it's sometimes not their fault, but it sucks being told over and over again, like, why, you know, who you are doesn't matter, or who you are is not in line with what other people expect. So I would just say, like, it takes time, it's really hard, but like life is this like cycle of trying to figure out communicating in finer and finer detail, or in more layered ways that are new and exciting. And people respond to different things, you know, like music, or you know, how something feels on your skin, or you know, like, yeah, maybe an Instagram story, you know, maybe a dance, like, but there are other ways out and other ways to get things out beyond what you think people are telling you to do. It's really, yeah, I don't know how to explain it. I'm just saying that.
Yeah.
I think that often adults really suck, and they really, really don't try to understand, and they really don't put in enough effort to like, they just assume they're right, or they assume they're better, or they assume they're wiser, and it's simply not true. And I would trust your intuition and trust your knowledge and trust your lived experience 1000%. And use that to like guide your decisions. That's mainly what I want to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a different but great message that we've had before, that we've had someone say. And I guess before we end off, is there anything you would like to plug? Upcoming shows, websites, social medias, whatever.
I guess I'm like working on a comic book that will be out sometime next year. I have a record label that it's been going for 11 years, and I'm about to release two albums next month. The record label is called N Out Recordings. The two albums I'm releasing are by a band called Ragana, who are from the Bay. It's two women who are from the Pacific Northwest who live in the Bay. Or one of them lives in the Bay, one of them is in Libya. But yeah, you know, two cool queer people who are also anti-fascist and anarchists, and they make gorgeous music. And so two of their albums on vinyl are coming out in December on my record label. So yeah, and that's my Instagram too, is N Out Recordings.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming and having this conversation with us.
Yeah,
Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 23 de noviembre del 2021. Angela Merkel, la canciller interina de Alemania, habría dicho a los líderes de su partido que las medidas del COVID-19 son insuficientes y advirtió que el país se encuentra en una situación muy dramática. Estamos en una situación muy dramática. Lo que está en su lugar ahora no es suficiente, dijo a los líderes de la Unión Demócrata Cristiana de Alemania en una reunión, según dos participantes, informa Reuters. A las personas en Austria no se les permite